I'm not the only kid who grew up this way. Surrounded by people who used to say that rhyme about sticks and stones. As if broken bones hurt more than the names we got called, and we got called them all. So we grew up believing no one would ever fall in love with us. That we'd be lonely forever. That we'd never meet someone to make us feel like the sun was something they built for us in their tool shed.
So broken. That's Shane Coyson, and he's reading a poem called To This Day over a video that was animated by volunteers. It became a YouTube sensation, racking up 5 million views in a week.
Poetry for me was always, it was just more direct emotionally than any other form of writing. I write all kinds of stuff, but poetry to me seemed like, you know, as much as they told us in line, you know, the shortest distance between two points is a line, poetry was able to connect the dots between my emotions.
But before Coyson had poetry, there was the daily hell at school of being singled out for being different.
I was very fortunate to have a grandmother who, you know, was very insistent that we talk every day. You know, when she found out I was being bullied, she was devastated. She was like, how can this happen? She just made a point of, like, I mean, really going through my day with me and talking about it, so that by the end of the day, my batteries were recharged enough that it's like, all right, let's take on another one, because I know I'm gonna have the support waiting for me when I get home.
But for kids growing up in the 21st century, the bully's reach has extended beyond the classroom. Social media has opened up the floodgates to cyberbullying, where relentless hate and manic meanness is dished out 24/7.
What I have been fascinated and appalled by is that nastiness is still very much the order of the day. You know, when people build up these online power bases, it's difficult to get them to stop. And I think people are starting to understand the impact of bullying, but I'm wondering what you think could be done to imbue the meanest of the mean with a little empathy, with some understanding of their actions. I mean, this video certainly is a very noble start, but there's something about online culture, there's something about our present day where meanness seems to be ubiquitous.
You know, it's hard because it's one of those things that people don't necessarily understand unless they've been through it. And so how do you do that? Like, we don't have a machine where we can sit the other person in it and say, okay, here's what you're doing to me.
Yeah.
You know, this is what it feels like. And I think if people felt that, you know, like, I mean, a lot of it's going to come down to compassion. And the tricky thing about compassion is it has to happen on both sides.
Yeah.
You know, there are going to be people who just, you know, it will not resonate with them. It will not get through to them. And so a lot of times you just have to turn that off. You know, people ask me, it's like, why did I leave the comments on for YouTube? Because, you know, there's people on there who are, you know, saying nasty things and whatnot. And you're always going to have that, but it's like, you have to leave it open, because what if there are two people out there who really connect on this thing, you know, and I didn't want it to be censored. And those comments, just don't take the bait. You know, they're there for the bait. They want to have that, you know, they want to get that rise out of you. They want that frustration to come out, and just walk away from it.
But do you think compassion is enough to get people to stop bullying, to get people to stop being abusive? Some people want to cling to the idea of, they were the victim. Often what happens is that the bully, when he's not being victimized, claims that other people are bullying him. So there's this perception situation. So, you know, is compassion enough? I mean, how does that translate into understanding?
Well, it's like, it's an ongoing, you know, as my people say it all the time, it's a conversation. It really is a conversation. It's something that's, you know, is going to need to continue to happen. There's no one answer. There's not a pill we're going to take. There's not a program we can download. It's us talking to one another and that's the only tool we have. And it's like, how do we make another person understand? It's like words seem insufficient. And, you know, it's like, I'm a writer and I'm trying my best. But at a certain point, language fails. How do we move beyond that? I don't have an answer. I don't have a solution to say, like, here's what we're going to do. This is what's going to work, and then have it work. You know, it really is just us talking through it.
Bullying is the most common form of violence in America and often carries into adulthood. Every day, more than 160,000 students stay home from school because they fear being bullied. Well, this week, we get into it. We talk with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, to learn more about why this goes on. We talk with the distinguished author James Lasden about a relentless student who cyberstalked him and refuses to stop to this very day. And we find out how an innocent girl with progeria was relentlessly tortured by cyberbullies who reviled her for no good reason at all. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears. Episode 6, Bullies.
You can definitely apply this label online and in the workplace.
That's Emily Bazelon, senior editor at Slate, and the author of a new book called Sticks and Stones. And we're trying to establish just what bullying is. There's this Swedish psychologist named Dan Alveus, and he defines bullying by three criteria: verbal or physical aggression that is repeated over time, and that involves a power imbalance. But when we start talking beyond the classroom, well, the terms become a little more difficult to pin down.
There's actually this heated academic debate going on right now about the online part of the definition. The way I think about it is this: kids' lives are fluid. They move between school and their real life world to their virtual world. And so it seems to me that you could have one instance of bullying online, and if it was part of a repetition of cruelty and meanness, and some of that was in person, that would all be kind of roll up into the same phenomenon. And so that's how I think about it.
Roll up, how so?
Well, because usually kids are not simply bullying online. Usually there's in-person interactions that are at the root of whatever's going on. And so what you see is that kids are mean and cruel in school and or, you know, at the mall, and then also take that behavior online to them. And so that's how it's all connected.
Dan Alveus, the Swedish psychologist I was mentioning earlier, has developed this anti-bullying program that's in place at many of America's schools right now. But the program takes several years before you start seeing results. So where does self-sufficiency fit into all this? Don't kids have to learn how to stick up for themselves?
They absolutely do. And I think one of the trickiest parts of this issue is that we not go so far in the direction of trying to help kids that we end up shutting down the avenues they need to grow. Like, they have to have some independence. And kids need to learn how to deal with adversity. That's a really important skill for them to exercise. I don't think the people in the bullying prevention world, however, are imagining some perfect realm of kindness in which no mean word is spoken. It's more about just sort of reducing the level of meanness and helping schools and kids come up with ways in which that behavior isn't rewarded. Because what we have in some schools now is a situation in which, in order to become powerful and popular, you have to be mean. Like, that's the route that pays off. And so then the question is, like, how do you change that around and reward the empathy and the kindness instead? But we're never going to live in this whitewashed world where it's all gone. So in some ways, I don't worry that much that, suddenly kids are going to have no opportunity for self-assertion.
Hey, you, get your damn hands off.
We care a lot in this country about the idea of standing up for yourself. And then the question is, what's the best route to do that? So one thing people talk about a lot is the idea that why don't you just punch the bully in the nose? That question gets asked a lot. Now, schools are not allowed to countenance violence, so they can't give that advice. But sometimes it's true that it may be that being aggressive, the victim's aggression can make the bully back down. On the other hand, there's some pretty good research that shows that tends to backfire. For one thing, victims are usually physically less strong, and sometimes they can fly off the handle in the course of responding in a way that really backfires. So there's reason to be somewhat cautious, and I think the real answer is it depends on the kid. There are some kids who can figure out how to stand up for themselves successfully, but a lot of kids who are victims tend to be physically weaker and submissive. And so, for example, in my book, there's a girl named Monique who is having a terrible long, prolonged experience of bullying. And her mom said to her at this one point, when you started a new school, if someone does this again, you need to stand up to them. And Monique was taking boxing at the time, so she was learning to punch. But she said, you know, I only fight in the ring. It just wasn't her nature to become someone who is going to be physically aggressive.
But even with anti-bullying programs in place, some school principals remain quite fond of the heart-to-heart. That if you put the bully and the victim in the same room to talk it out for a few hours, everything will be just fine. It turns out, this idea is a bad one.
So I think it comes from this well-intended idea that if you put two people in a room together, they'll get to know each other, their misconceptions will drop away. And there's also been some history of peer mediation working in schools in conflict situations. The problem is that peer mediation is not a good remedy for bullying. Peer mediation works among people who are equals, but bullying, is, as we were talking about, is all about this power dynamic. And so what you find is exactly what you were saying, that the bully will say what the grown-up wants to hear and then, you know, give the other kid a very hard time for snitching. That's often the dynamic. And you just don't want to set that up. So in a situation of a bully and a victim, just having them sit down together is not going to solve the problem.
During the production of this program, I secured an interview with Ben Shapiro, the author of Bullies. I made the mistake of scheduling the interview before reading the book. Then I read Shapiro's book in full and discovered that the argument was not satisfactory enough to meet the minimum level of engagement for this program. So, I canceled the interview. But, to be fair to Shapiro, I put forth one of his points to Bazelon. With problems like war and drones and the economy, why should we be concerned with bullying?
Right. So I would say this. I mean, I would not compare the problem of bullying in America to, you know, the search for global peace. They're on different levels. And whenever you're talking about real violence, you're talking about an incredibly serious problem. What I'd say about bullying is that it has long-term serious consequences for kids on both sides of the equation. So for bullies, it's associated with low grades and substance abuse later in life and actually like more juvenile and adult crime and, you know, in serious cases can be linked to suicide. So that's the case for addressing it on that side. And for victims, there also can be these longer-term consequences of depression and low academic performance. And, you know, there's some evidence that there is an association with suicide, or at least suicidal attempts and thinking.
The long-term effects of bullying were confirmed in a report published in late February by JAMA Psychiatry. 1,420 kids from Western North Carolina were asked about bullying at various points in their life over a 20-year period by a group of psychologists led by Dr. William Copeland of Duke University. For subjects who had been bullied in school, depression and anxiety continued into their 20s. I spoke with Dr. Copeland to learn more about this unprecedented undertaking.
You know, we've known for a long time about how damaging bullying can be in terms of children's short-term functioning, and there's a lot of studies linking it to depression, anxiety, and suicidal behavior in childhood. There hasn't been a lot that's kind of followed these kids up. You know, years after the bullying has stopped and they've transitioned into adulthood, to see what they look like in terms of their emotional functioning. So the first thing that we really added is kind of taking this group of kids that we've been following for 20 years and to look at how they're functioning in adulthood at ages 19, 21, and 25. The second thing that I think is really important is the question is always, is it actually the bullying or are these kids having trouble before they get bullied? Okay, and it's those problems, the kind of pre-existing problems that are predicting these long-term outcomes. And because we'd been following these kids so closely for such an extended period of time, we were really able to account for exactly how they were functioning before they were bullying and to look at the independent effect of being bullied. And the effects were pretty dramatic.
So how were you able to isolate bullying from pre-existing psychiatric problems? That's one of the fascinating things, I think, about this study, the ability for you to look at bullying almost as an independent problem, something that is completely separate from, say, physical or sexual abuse or family dysfunction or poverty. How were you able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, through very in-depth interviews that we did multiple times with these kids when they were children. So we started out with these kids when they were 9, 11, and 13. And every year we would do an extensive interview with the kids themselves, but then also with one of their parents. And in some cases, we interviewed the kids and their parents up to 6 times by the time they reached age 16 years old. And in these interviews, we would be asking them about their emotional functioning. We'd ask them about how things are going at home, about whether or not they had been maltreated. So we were collecting all this information while they were children, and now when we're looking at the effect of bullying, we can kind of account for those kind of pre-existing factors in all of our models and can kind of really separate out what is specific to bullying and then what is just related to, you know, kind of other sorts of problems that kids have in childhood.
So what kind of enduring or lasting psychiatric damage does bullying have based off of this study? Are we now reaching a point where bullying is becoming a more dangerous behavior, something that is really going to cause great psychological problems that we really have been in the dark about now that we know that bullying has effects into adulthood? What does your study do to demystify our present understanding of bullying?
Well, I'll say this. The way that this study came about was me giving, you know, actually a talk at Duke and having someone raise their hand and ask if we studied bullying and whether or not it had long-term effects on, you know, kids' outcomes. And I was very skeptical early on that we were going to find these effects. And I was very skeptical, especially, that we'd find these effects after accounting for those kind of pre-existing emotional problems and family adversities that I just talked about. When we looked at this, you really have to be thinking about three different groups. There was kids that were just victims in childhood. There were kids that were just bullies in childhood. And then there were kids that were both bullies and victims. And each of those three groups had different long-term outcomes. So the victims were at about 4 or 5 times increased risk for having anxiety disorders in adulthood, things like generalized anxiety, panic disorder, and agoraphobia. The bully victims, the folks that both were bullied and then went on to bully other people, had the worst long-term outcomes. Fortunately, this was just a small group, about 5% of our sample. But these kids were at increased risk for depression, for suicidal thoughts and behavior, for panic disorder, and for agoraphobia. And so they really were having the most trouble in adulthood. And then the final group are the folks that were just bullies. And when we followed them up, there was really no evidence that they were having kind of emotional problems in adulthood, although they did have elevated rates of something called antisocial personality disorder, which is basically characterized by kind of showing a pervasive disregard for others and the rights of others. So what it sounds like is that there are some of these bullies that are continuing to mistreat people now that they're adults as well.
So I'm curious about the bully victims. I mean, were you able to isolate what came first in some of these cases? Do you have enough data if they were bullied first or they bullied first? Do we know enough about this bully victim phenomenon?
Right. I mean, that's really the interesting follow-up question for us, and we're doing some work right now on, you know, kind of anatomy of a bully victim, and trying to answer exactly the questions that you're talking about. It's always been presumed, and there's some evidence to suggest, that these kids are kind of victimized first. And they may not be functioning very well socially at school, and they also may have some challenges at home too. And so then, you know, they kind of react out of anger to being bullied, and they see bullying other kids that they perceive as weaker than them as maybe the only way to kind of get on the social map at school and the only way to get any attention at all, because maybe they're not successful in other ways at school. These are often kids that, you know, might not have a lot of friends or get along with other people. Maybe they're a little bit more impulsive than their peers, and they're a little bit more aggressive too. So there may be some evidence with that group that there's kind of some underlying issues to begin with that are just kind of exacerbated by, you know, being bullied and then by starting to kind of perpetrate against other people. Because when you think about it, you know, when somebody's bullied, typically then they're going to have a lot of empathy for people that are bullied, and they're going to be much less likely to do it. And these kids were seeing exactly the opposite pattern. So I think that this suggests that they're having some real challenges to begin with.
Does any of your data take into account the power dynamic that is at play between the bully and the victim? Because that's the one aspect of bullying which I think is being swept underneath the carpet in the ongoing national discussion. What did your data say about power differentials?
Well, this is I think the defining feature of kind of that bullying relationship. For whatever reason, the bully feels like they have some sort of power over the victim, and it may be because of size or intelligence or social skill, or maybe the the kid has some very different interests. For whatever reason, the bully feels like this is someone where they can kind of get away with mistreating them. And the thing that I think is really insidious about this power dynamic is what often happens is there's others kind of standing around or watching or seeing this happen. There's kind of bystanders when there's bullying. And often these other kids will say, hey, we didn't really think this was right. We wished that, Joey would stop doing this, but we didn't actually feel comfortable, saying or doing anything. So, I mean, I think that there's a lot of work that can be done inside the schools in terms of kind of setting more of a kind of zero tolerance attitude toward this so that kids feel more free to kind of speak up and to say something, either to the bully or maybe to some a teacher or something like that. Because what we find is that the bully's power, seems to be, very strong in that moment, but it's actually very tenuous. And when somebody else speaks up and says, hey, cut that out, don't treat him like that, what often happens is bullies back down very quickly because these actually aren't, brave kids. In a lot of cases, they're cowards that are looking on, weaker people to pick on. So, I think it's important to kind of diffuse the apparent power that they have in this bullying situation, and there's a number of ways to go about doing that.
Do you feel that the Olveus programs that are being adopted by many schools right now to combat bullying, that this is something that is going to be effective, especially in relation to the data that you have actually uncovered in the last several years?
Yeah, I mean, in our schools, we don't have kids that have kind of gone through those programs, so we can't speak to that specifically in terms of our data. But these are programs that have some strong empirical basis to them, and obviously we want to disseminate them as much as possible. I think it needs to be broader than that, though, too. I actually, in my own mind, am kind of starting to shift my idea about what are the things that happen to kids that really kind of cause them challenges long term. As a child psychologist, typically the things that we think about and ask about have to do with home functioning. What's going on at home? How are you getting along with your parents? Are you being mistreated? So on and so forth. And we pay a lot less attention to how kids function at school and how they function with their peers and things like bullying. And I think what this study suggests is that emphasis may have been misplaced and that, some of the things that go on at school, and specifically bullying, can really have these very potent long-term effects. And so I think kind of, as a clinician and I think school personnel and parents and as a society, we just need to start to take the same sort of mindset about bullying that we take about other kinds of forms of maltreatment, the kinds that typically happen within the home.
Sure. One last question. One thing I understand about this study is that you didn't look at frequency of bullying, and this also doesn't distinguish between school bullying and other forms of bullying, such as cyberbullying. How does your study help others understand bullying that occurs outside the school, or bullying that occurs even in adulthood, in the workplace environment?
Right.
What does this say about that?
Yeah, well, the first thing is that although we didn't talk about the kind of how the frequency of the bullying in this paper, we absolutely collected that information and we're kind of looking at it right now. But it's also important to point out that most of the kids that were reported being bullying here were often reported being bullied quite a number of times. You know, so it was very uncommon for kids to report it, you know, kind of once or twice, and it was much more common to report it, you know, 5, 10, many more times than that. The other thing is that this study is a, you know, 20-year study where we've been following these kids who are now in their 30s, and since these kids have kind of grown up, bullying is changing. And so I think that as a society we're starting to kind of, you know, I think take, you know, start to view bullying as a real problem that we won't tolerate. But at the same time, bullying is getting much more insidious because a lot of it's happening, you know, behind closed doors on the internet, and of course what you're talking about in terms of the cyberbullying. And there's a lot less research on that at this point and how common that is and how can we intervene and how can we monitor those things, which are often completely out of, you know, a parent or a teacher's purview. And so I think, you know, this study, I think, starts to tell us what the long-term effects of bullying can be. And now that bullying is changing, we need to kind of find new ways to kind of address cyberbullying and, you know, realizing that we would expect that that could have the same long-term effects that we've observed in our study.
You read something, you tend to think it's true. All right, now we know with the internet to make an adjustment that in many cases it might not be true.
Do you think the fact that she bullied you through a medium that is very word-centric led these wounds to sting a little bit more? I mean, how did this change your own relationship with the written word?
Well, I mean, speaking of words, I'm not sure I would use the word bullied. Or I guess that is an appropriate word to use. It was never the word that came to my mind. I didn't sit there feeling I'm being bullied. I felt that it was, in a way, more dangerous,
more dangerous than being
more mysterious in some way. I think possibly not more dangerous, no, because more mysterious in some way. That there was just a form of harm being done to me. I suppose part of why bully didn't seem quite the word was that from Nazreen's point of view, she always perceived herself as a victim. And me as a person with power, and because she had been a student of mine, and because she was in many cases a more marginal kind of person, at least arguably in her own mind, and I think possibly objectively, you could say within the terms that we were talking about. I mean, I was a published writer; she wasn't, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't have quite the symmetries of bullying. It had its own strange symmetry, and her term for it was verbal terrorism, which is a very extreme and melodramatic term, and yet it seemed apt in a way.
Huh. So why wouldn't you use the word bullying, especially when we see ongoing incidents of cyberbullying, and bullying itself has stretched its latitude, I would say, in the last 5 years. Why do you feel that it just doesn't fit the case here?
Well, let me backtrack a little bit. It's not that I don't accept that that's the right word. It is. And a lot of while I was writing the book, various cyberbullying stories came to the fore. I mean, there were terrible, terrible stories of teenagers actually driven to suicide, in one case at least. And I suppose there tended to be a kind of pattern that it was a certain age group. For instance, it tended to be teenagers and younger. For me, that word has connotations of school, of high school. Out in the adult world, when somebody's trying to harm somebody else. Yeah, I guess bullying is an apt word, but In the end, I don't know what the word is for what was done to me. I mean, yes, bullying, stalking. It just seemed like I was at the receiving end of malice.
Yeah.
Call it whatever you want.
The one thing that is intriguing to me about this book is how you go back to texts. You go to Sir Gawain, Tintin, D.H. Lawrence. You go to Patricia Highsmith in an effort to try to understand almost whether your own reading is somehow reflected in Nazarene's communication. And I was wondering why this triggered certain kind of early points in reading for you and why this was the best way for you to make sense of what was going on.
Well, I was trying to make sense of something that was very mysterious to me, that was very drastic, that was very ongoing. It just was relentless for many, many years and just kept escalating, something that kept shifting as well in its form. I mean, it began with accusations of plagiarism, the levels of accusation then escalated to sexual misconduct. Then I was being accused of being part of a Jewish mafia selling her work to other writers. Then it moved from there to impersonating me on the web and then sending letters to emails to employers. This was something that was just so mysterious and so...
Without literary precedent?
Well, what I'm trying to say is I was trying to understand it. And you bring your own what you have to... I'm not a sociologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a writer. I've read quite a lot and I tend to think about books when I in relation to life in a quite intimate way, and when I'm trying to in the process of trying to understand it and trying to articulate what I was feeling, I found myself going back to certain texts that seemed to me to have to be able to shed a lot of light on different aspects of the story. So Gawain was very interesting to me. It's a story of psychological combat. It's also a story of the uncanny. And that was an aspect of this, that at a certain point I felt that I was in a very bizarre realm, that I couldn't think about what I wanted to think about. So in a sense, I was I felt like a person under a kind of curse. But I'm at the same time a rational human being, and I don't really have the terms that come totally naturally to describe that. Or at any rate, it seemed interesting to refract that sensation through something like Gawain. And there were other things that Gawain connected through. And then Patricia Highsmith's Strangers on a Train is a story of stalking. It's a story of a psychopath who stalks somebody and just keeps escalating the level of malice. And so that was an interesting thing. And it had bizarre little resemblances to my story, including there was one really high, I don't know if high or low is the word, but one extreme point in my story was when somebody I worked for called me into a room and said, "We've had a very strange email about you." And he was
yeah,
very nice about it and very understanding, but nevertheless, he had to kind of understand what was going on. He'd got an email denouncing me.
Frank, who also believed that you had actually had an affair with the students and said, "I don't care what you do."
Well, it wasn't that he believed that. Yeah. It's just that that wasn't something that he was going to get into. That's all. No, he was very civilized, and I'm very grateful to him. But he didn't feel that was an issue for him. He was more, I think it was just that he was more perplexed by the other part of her email, which had to do with me stealing her work. And she used this expression, day trading her fiction. And I think he was, just, as I was, he was perplexed by that. And he just wanted to understand it. And yet he did need to get to the bottom of it. He was the employer. It was an academic situation. And I had to explain it to him. And it was fine. I explained it to him. It was fine. And then I also told him that the police were involved and everything was totally fine. But nevertheless, just going through that process of having somebody tell you they've had an extremely unpleasant email about you is very uncomfortable indeed. And exactly that thing happens in Strangers on a Train at some point. So for me, it was interesting to see, well, how does Patricia Highsmith handle this as a novelist, and what if any resonances are there between the way it happens in her book and in the way it happened in my life.
The NYPD detective, who you call Bauer, after a certain Kiefer Sutherland character, he also believed in the day trading racket. And it's interesting to me that people wanted to believe that you were somehow snatching Nazarene stories and trying to pass them off as fiction, which shows a deep misunderstanding of the way that fiction works, because it's not some sort of cut-and-paste thing like that. Simultaneously, you go to this extraordinary length to defend your motivations and the true instance behind this story of a woman who coaxes men into her apartment by, you know, say, can you break down the door and all that. So there's almost this, it's the feel I had as a reader was that here was a defense attorney who was really overstating the case. So, you know, I have to ask why you feel this was the shadow of doubt here, that you were day trading stories possibly, and why you feel so compelled to defend something that I think most people involved with fiction are probably going to go ahead and forgive you or just sort of say, really? No, come on. That's not the way fiction works.
Maybe most people involved in fiction would say that. It's the people who are not involved in fiction that I was more concerned about. And with all these accusations that she threw at me, I was never concerned about the people I knew or people who knew me. I was just concerned about what you do when accusations about you are flung up on the web and you feel very vulnerable to them. And I began, in fact, writing the book as a document. I felt I just needed to lay out the sequence of events, put in the emails of this person, the relatively sane ones as well as the completely crazy ones, so that it would become apparent the nature of the person making the accusations. And it was going to be, yes, it was just going to be something I was going to post online as a document of defense. But in the course of writing it, all kinds of other things came up in my mind that interested me, things I had been interested in for a long time, like codes of conduct, the question of reputation, honor, these concepts that were once, that we considered antiquated up until, in my view, the internet, which has revived them in some way, the question of anti-Semitism, which was another big feature of her emails. And so I decided I would take on everything that came naturally to mind as I was telling the story. So the story of the stalking is a sort of central spine of the book, but off it are these tangents, I suppose, these reflections on subjects that seem to naturally arise. And then I go back to the main story and look at the main story through the tangential stories. Having said that, I have to go back to what you said about the detective. It wasn't it wasn't that he said he believed that I was stealing her work. It was that he actually wasn't in a position. Why would a New York detective know enough about the creative writing business to be absolutely sure that this kind of thing doesn't go on, that teachers do not steal their students' work and sell it to other writers? That at least, it's very preposterous, that as a scenario. And I never... When she first started accusing me of that and accusing the other people who she was also sending hate mail to, I thought that was so ridiculous and so preposterous that nobody could possibly ever believe it. But then, after talking to the detective, I realized that this is not... It may seem preposterous to a writer, it may seem preposterous to someone in the literary business, but actually, most people who are not writers think that the writing business is... full of plagiarism, full of theft. The first thing that somebody who's never written a book before but who decides to write a book, the first thing they want to know about is, how do I copyright my material? And the first thing they start thinking about is, who's going to steal it? So actually...
And when you have successful books, whether it be Harry Potter or Nicholas Meyer back in the day, there's always a lawsuit accusing of plagiarism that generally gets thrown out.
Yeah, but it's an extremely unpleasant thing to have to go through.
So in a way, this idea that you were somehow lifting other people's stories was, if we can call reputation a gentleman's second soul, you were defending your second soul, your books, your work.
I was. And the book is, to some extent, an act of self-defense, self-protection. But I wouldn't have published it if it was only that. I mean, who else is going to be interested in that? That would have been something I would have just posted online. But I hope that the book has a kind of larger reach than that.
Yeah. So the Wall Street Journal called you curiously passive in the face of this diabolical onslaught. Near the end of the book, you note that you couldn't even bring yourself to face Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the Holocaust official Israeli memorial there, while you were there. You also don't bring up the issue of contacting the authorities until the last half of the book. So this leads me to ask, are you just not a confrontational guy? Is this book your way of confronting the issue? Do you feel that you should be even placed in that position of confronting Nazarene in some formal way? Why was this delayed for so long? What was the real story here?
Well, it was delayed in the book, but it wasn't delayed in life. I mean, there's a point where it's a story that required a lot of pieces to be in place to make sense. And I mentioned that I'd gone to the police at the point where it seemed crucial to mention that. There were many other things that I had to mention before. So I don't accept that criticism at all. I don't consider myself to be a passive person. I would like to know what the hell that guy thinks I could have done that I didn't do. I went to the FBI, I went to the police, I had lawyers send her a cease and desist letter. The situation is now has developed since I wrote the book. It's in the hands of the hate crimes unit of the NYPD. I think that was a preposterous remark to make of the reviewer. And certainly to make and then not say, well, what could I have done that I didn't do? I really did everything, and I don't consider myself passive.
But the issue does raise a point, because I thought, while reading the book, well, why has he not said anything? And then you come in with this late part of the book where you say, well, actually, I did do that. This sort of demonstrates maybe the difficulties of conveying this aspect of the narrative, perhaps, or how you actually are being judged by this Wall Street Journal guy as being somewhat passive simply because you frame that event late in the narrative. I mean,
well, the event's there in the narrative. I mean, you can read a book, you could see that. I mean, I don't think the fact that I place it where I do makes it any less true. But you know, there is a reason, and then of course it has an effect. Where you say something in a story has an effect on the way the story is read, and I'm aware of that, and I'm aware that it was a question that would have been building in any reader's mind. Why doesn't he go to the police? Why hasn't he been to the FBI? And to some extent, I found that, and it's rather hard to explain why, but to some extent I found that to be a useful kind of tension to have over the story. And to some extent, it perhaps does express my, the fact is that those attempts, the going to the police didn't produce any results.
Yeah.
I mean, they were all failures in a sense. Going to the FBI, nothing produced a result. So the story at that level is about powerlessness to deal with it in official terms.
So you wanted to present yourself in a sort of powerless position to give the reader the sense of what you were feeling.
That is what I was feeling. It was entirely what I was feeling. And going to the FBI made me feel even more powerless. Initially going to the police felt good, you know, and the guy was helpful. He wanted to help, but he was up against a problem, which was that she had moved to California. This was a aggravated harassment, which is a misdemeanor. They don't normally extradite for misdemeanors. It's just not serious enough to warrant the expense. So he said right from the get-go, look, there are things we might be able to do. I can call her. We can maybe get her visited by cops out in L.A., but it's unlikely that the New York district attorney is going to actually authorize an extradition. And that was what I was up against. That it was just fell between different kinds of legal possibilities.
Sure. So you went to London to investigate a hate letter that was received by your father at the Victoria and Albert Museum, where his archives are. The letter contained anti-Semitic phrases, a swastika drawn on the outside of the envelope. There's the faint suggestion here that getting these emails from Nazarene is almost part of a regrettable and unplanned family legacy. So I have to ask, how does going to the past like this help you reckon with the indignities of the present?
I'm not sure that it helps me reckon with the indignities of the present, but it's part of the process of trying to understand what was going on, trying to write about it, was dealing with that aspect of it, the anti-Semitism, which was a very bizarre surprise that when Nasreen's emails turned from just being obsessive, you know, 10 emails a day, but relatively innocuous in their content, turned from that to being out-and-out hate mail, which they did overnight. Almost immediately, this anti-Semitism came in as a part of it, which this is somebody I'd taught. I knew her. I'd never had any indication of this at all. And once it began, it became increasingly violent. And it was vile. It was really horrible. You know, awful, awful. But I didn't know what to make of it. I mean, I didn't feel personally threatened by that aspect of it. That was, in many ways, on the personal level, the least threatening. I mean, you know, I'm Jewish, and I spend my time in the Catskills and New York. I don't feel like I'm a member of a vulnerable minority. But it had an effect, nevertheless. And it one of the things that it forced me to do was think about what it does mean to be Jewish. I'm not religious. I grew up in a totally assimilated household. And yet my parents considered themselves Jews. I mean, it was a rather complicated relationship with their own Jewishness. But that interested me, to think about that, to think about, well, what does it mean when it's actually more somebody else's defining of you that makes you Jewish than anything that you necessarily feel within yourself? And I wanted to explore that. I wanted to dig into that, but not as a way of
settling a score.
More like a pursuit of resonances.
Precisely.
Yeah. So, you know, what resonances do you think you found by seeing the fact that your father almost went through the same thing by post instead of by email?
Well, he just got this.
He got one.
My father was an architect, and he, at one time in his career, was commissioned to design a synagogue in Jerusalem. It didn't actually get built, but it occupied him for 4 years, and he published the design in the architectural journal, and it was in response to that that he got this violently anti-Semitic email. Not email, letter. It was something that and he took me aside when I was 18, 19 at the time, and he took me aside. He was very, very perplexed by it. Disturbed, but not completely, you know, it was just a one-off thing. He was disturbed. He didn't know what to make of it. And I didn't know what to make of it. I'd never seen anything like it. It was all the kind of, you know, Hitler was right and the swastikas scrawled all over it, that kind of thing. And naturally, I found myself thinking about that. When I started getting that kind of a spate of emails like that. But at the same time, I was thinking, well, is there actually any connection, or is it just a kind of random haphazard thing? And in many ways, of course, it is. It's just he happened to get it, I happened to get it. So what? Nevertheless, you can't if you're in a very stressed situation, as I was, you start seeing significance in things like that. It doesn't mean that they are significant. But what I was trying to do in the book was to record that feeling of significance and to let it stand as so it was subjectively significant to me. So what can I deduce from it?
Sure. So you remark several times in the book on what you style at one point as the necessity of using private emails in a story about accusations of plagiarism and violations of privacy. How do you feel that you are invading Nasreen's privacy? I mean, doesn't her relentless behavior exonerate you to some degree? Why feel guilty about fighting back or trying to stand up for your identity or even your second soul?
Well, I felt that she was violating my privacy. It's not that I thought I'm violating her privacy. And so I personally don't have any doubts about needing to use her emails. But I was articulating a thought that I assumed some readers would have, because after all, her attacks begin as accusations that I've stolen her work, and here I am publishing a book full of her emails. So to some readers, that's going to seem like What an irony! What a paradox to me. And so I had to deal with that. I had to lay it out and say, yes, that is something I have to come to terms with, because I couldn't possibly tell this story without using the emails, and I feel that I have a right to tell the story. This is somebody who spent 5 years trying to destroy me. I don't have any compunction about that. But yeah, that's a question that arises in some people's minds. Well, you have stolen them now, some people might say, but I don't agree. And I think the irony is a completely superficial one. Nevertheless, there it is.
So you just wanted to address that particular inquisitive reader. Do you feel that Nazarene is entitled to any kind of respect, even after she has done, or even after what she has done?
I think every human being is entitled to respect, and don't exempt her from that at all. And this book is not in any way an attack on her. In fact, I think it's quite the opposite. I think it is quite a respectful book about her, to the extent that it is about her. Obviously, her own words in her emails are pretty damning of her, but I have... to me, there would be no point just sort of writing a book of a retaliatory abuse. I wanted to try to understand her. I wanted to try to see the situation that she and I were in as much from her point of view as I could, without making assumptions that were impossible to back up. So I think of it as a not at all a disrespectful book.
So this incident in the espresso bar, where this guy comes up to you and says, "Seek hail," and it becomes a near-violent altercation, do you think that it was really Nazarene's emails that pushed you to that particular point? Or did some of this have to do with the soul-searching you were doing at the time, the efforts to find out, well, what is my identity? Who am I? And things like that. I mean, it seems to me, based off of the clear pain and hurt that you've suffered from this, that there just seemed to be a lot of soul searching going on. So what do you think pushed you to that particular point at the espresso bar?
That was stress. That was just about stress. That, I don't think that had anything much to do with soul searching or identity or anything like that. I gave that story where somebody was rude to me in an espresso bar, and I overreacted, and I felt myself coming close to seriously overreacting, and I thought that you know, it's one thing while you're writing a narrative to say I felt very stressed, but you, as a writer, you want to find a more kind of dramatic expression of it. And I was trying to think of, what were the circumstances where that stress expressed itself most dramatically? And that was one. And it seemed to me that would indicate the level of just how grueling this thing had been, and what its effect on me was to show myself in a situation where, I mean, as I said earlier, I don't think I'm passive, but I'm not the most aggressive person, probably, under normal circumstances, and so to come close to violence like that was a sort of indication of what I felt of what I was going through. It wasn't particularly about identity or anything like that.
Was that the hardest you were pushed in relation to this stress, or are there just things that you dealt with that you just could not write about?
Mostly it was the sort of traditional, classic stress symptoms. I mean, extreme insomnia, extreme anxiety.
You started smoking again, yeah.
Well, that was from an earlier incident. Okay. But I don't think that there was another particular scene that would have shown you how stressed I was, but just a great deal of feeling of wretchedness.
Do you think that Nazarene should be punished, and how should she be punished?
Oh, I'm not interested in punishment. I'm just interested in bringing an end to this very unpleasant experience.
It's still going on.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know how you sort of declare an ending to this. I mean, I haven't heard from her for several months. But the last time I did hear was actually she moved from emails to the phone.
Really?
And left a series of really sort of very disturbing messages. Among them was one where she said, "This is never going to end."
Wow.
So I don't know. That's what I would like, is for it to end. And ideally, in practical terms, I think I'm still hoping that she will be arrested, and that there's some possibility that might occur.
Hey guys, my mommy's gonna make a wig, and he's got lipstick on, and
That's Adalia Rose. She's a 5-year-old girl suffering from progeria who lives in a modest apartment with her single mother. Her videos harmed no one, but as Camille Dodero reported in a lengthy investigative piece published on Gawker, these harmless videos became a dark magnet for 4chan.
One of the subsets, B, discovered Adalia's page. It's unclear what exactly prompted them to come across it, but it just seemed to happen overnight where her page skyrocketed overnight from 600 likes to about 10,000. Initially, there were a few negative comments, so it's unclear if B discovered it first or if another site did, but it happened in a really quick succession within less than a week. It went from 600 likes to all of a sudden horrible, positive love outflowing letters from strangers to, horrible negative things being said.
But who would find this torment funny?
Something I guess I've learned in the process of doing this particular story is that the thing that they find funny is the reaction that it elicits from other people. They find it funny that anybody responds in a way. They find all the people screaming and crying and telling them that they're, being horrible. They find that funny. And this is like a 14-year-old boy mentality. I mean, I'm not saying everyone who's a troll is a 14-year-old, but it actually, for a long time, I wondered, who would do this? And it turns out, by and large, it's young teenage boys who are just sort of I can't possibly say that I understand what they're thinking exactly, but they find their response funny. That's the joke to them.
I have nothing against Adalia Rose. I have not made any pictures about the girl. But I see the humor in what people are trying to display. It's a different type of humor that people aren't used to. They do. It's not going to stop. The only way that it will stop is if she stops posting pictures of herself. If she wasn't whoring herself out, she probably would have never been noticed.
That's the troll who instigated the smear campaign against Adalia Rose. Notice his strange defense. Adalia brought the trolls on by uploading videos to Facebook. And according to the troll, Adalia had it coming.
One of the things he said was into that point, reiterating it, was you wouldn't let your kid walk down, since you're from New York, you wouldn't let your kid walk down bad neighborhoods in Brooklyn. And I'm like, well, but that doesn't really hold up, because what you're saying is that you shouldn't let your kid walk anywhere in America or anywhere in New York City. Being on the internet is not that's all encompassing. And he sort of was like, yeah, I get he doesn't. The answer is that somebody like that doesn't find any distinctions. He can't see the geographical, or because not geographical, he can't see the boundaries. This is why I spent so much time in the story, and this is why I was so fascinated by it, is because these aren't simple, these aren't simple questions or simple answers.
In a schoolyard, the bully is motivated by a power dynamic or perhaps a lack of compassion. But give the bully a medium and an audience, and it's just possible that he'll be pulled into the steel jaws of another American sickness.
The pure fame lust is something I think we really underestimate. If you get a little older, you're like, well, why would you want, why are people on reality TV? It's the same kind of thing. I see absolutely that this instinct. I mean, have you heard of Hunter Moore? he's a similar case in that, his need for attention, he was willing to do anything to kind of satisfy that.
Until we can find a common point of compassion between bullies and their victims, the bullying problem won't go away anytime soon. But if you felt victimized or down in the dumps because another person was mean to you, I pass along some wise words from Eleanor Roosevelt. Nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent. That's our show for this week. Tune in 2 weeks from now for a new episode. Until then, we encourage you to follow your ears. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. Our thanks to Shane Coison, Emily Bazelon, Dr. William Copeland, James Lasden, and Camille Dodaro for their time, wisdom, and courage in discussing a very difficult issue. And don't forget to visit our website at followyourears.com for all our episodes. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.